joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Best-selling author John Krakauer is known for his page-turning outdoor adventure nonfiction, Into the Wild and Into Thin Air. His latest book is very different. He investigates campus rape cases in Missoula, Montana. He started researching sexual assault after he learned a woman he knew well had been raped by acquaintances. The title of his new book is Missoula, Rape and the Justice System in a College Town. John Krakauer joins me in the studio. Do feel free to call us at 800-433-8850. Send an email to drshow@wamu.org. Follow us on Facebook or send us a tweet. John, it's good to see you again.
It's an honor to be back.
Oh, John, thank you. Boy, did you kick a hornet's nest.
Yeah, apparently so. People are pretty riled up about this one.
They really are. I've got lots of publicity, especially from Missoula, Montana. How did you get involved in writing this book?
As you mentioned in the intro, a young woman whom I've known since she was born, very, very close to my wife and me, and she was this high achiever, seemed to be, you know, her life was on a fast track, doing great in her late 20s. And to my huge surprise, she turned up in a rehab facility, a treatment facility for addiction and sexual abuse. And it was when I found out why, that she had been raped a decade earlier and that the trauma from that had... As I put it in the book, it was as if not only did the guys who raped her steal her innocence, they turned her into a kind of a ghost who is trapped in the moment of being violated over and over, perpetually, for this decade. And that, you know, drove her to seek relief in very unhealthy compulsions. So, you know, once I learned about that, first of all, I was deeply ashamed, both that I was unaware of this person's troubles, and that also that I knew so little about the prevalence of sexual assault or the extreme and lasting nature of the trauma that victims have to deal with.
And indeed, this book comes out shortly after what happened in North Carolina became so very public, and in the end, the Columbia Journalism Review has written a huge piece about what the newspaper that wrote the original article, saying, you know, it hadn't examined carefully enough, it hadn't reported carefully enough. This is a tough issue to report about.
It is. And, you know, Rolling Stone went wrong because they didn't corroborate the victim's claims. They trusted her, which is good, but you have to trust but verify, as Ronald Reagan said. I mean, you need to believe victims. You have to start by believing, but then you have to corroborate. You know, this was before the Rolling Stone University of Virginia fiasco when I started working on this book in 2012. But even so, you know, I knew the challenges. So I decided to rely on a paper trail, you know, documents, recordings, you know, cases that had been adjudicated or there were transcripts. I certainly talked to the victims, but it was all backed up by literally thousands of pages of documents. So,
and did your friend go to this university?
No. Her case was not. She was raped when she was very young, still in high school, by a friend she trusted, and then later she was raped by a family friend, an older man, who our family treated as, you know, one of the family. So. It was very tragic.
So then, why did you choose Missoula?
Well, so I had my, you know, once I decided to educate myself, you know, as soon as you start looking, it's everywhere, as you pointed out, North Carolina, University of Virginia, Amherst, Harvard, Columbia, you know, and Notre Dame. It just goes, there's now more than 100 schools the government's looking at. So one of them was Missoula. It was in the news. There was this scandal. There was a very provocative article in Jezebel, the blog, that caught my attention. So, and I live in the West. I live in Colorado. Missoula's close. I love Montana. I've spent a lot of time there. So, you know, I'd rather go to Missoula to investigate a case than I would go to Tallahassee. So it was kind of random. It was random. I read about a sentencing hearing for a guy named Bo Donaldson, a football player who raped a woman named Allison Huguette. And I didn't expect much. I thought I'd go and maybe I'd learn something. Probably not. But when I went in January of 2013, it was riveting. And Allison Huguette, when she took the witness stand and was being, you know, badgered and browbeaten by the typical defense attorney whose job is to make her look like the guilty party, she didn't take it. She gave it right back. She was this small, unassuming woman who had channeled her hurt and rage into this, I don't know, this fierce determination to get the truth out. And when I saw her, I thought, that's when I decided I could maybe write a book about her case. And at first it was just going to be her case. But then I realized, no, wait, her case is part of this pattern. So I just expanded it to examine a series of sexual assaults from 2010 through 2012, I guess it was.
Did Allison have any reservation about allowing you to use her real name?
No, and that worried me. I mean, when I first said, I think I might want to write a book about you, but I have to think about it for a little while. And then I came back to her and said, yeah, I do, but I want you to wait a month, and I'm going to spend that month trying to talk you and your parents out of it. And she was like, I'm not going to change my mind, but whatever, if you want me to wait a month. And she had been so vilified. I mean, this is her assailant, Bo Donaldson. She was very smart. She'd been drinking at a party, but she wasn't super drunk. But she was too drunk to drive home, so she slept. She was invited to spend the night on a couch in his living room. She woke up in the middle of the night being raped by him when she was asleep. So she was so traumatized. But she had the presence of mind. The next day, she and her best friend, who was also at the party, decided they would ask Bo to come over to her house on this Sunday morning and demand a confession. This was her best friend since she was in first grade. This was someone she trusted like a brother. He was like a member of her family. This isn't a stranger. I mean, you know, we all think of strangers as the guy who climbs into an upstairs window and, you know, a stranger who then uses a gun to force women to submit. Well, 85% of rapes are acquaintance rapes. They're rapes by people who know the victim, often who know the victim well. This was this woman's best friend, literally. And so she got him, you know, at first he claimed, oh, no, it was consensual. We were making out. She says, you know, don't try to fool me. You know, it was not. And he admits this. And she'd hidden a tape recorder in the cushions of her couch, which is not admissible as evidence in Montana. But she got this taped confession. Without that, in Montana, with a football player, he might not have even been charged. And this is a town where the prosecutors were so reluctant to charge any case that wasn't an absolute slam dunk. You know, if there's any question, and it's a tough town to win convictions because in the University of Montana is in Missoula. It's got an extremely successful football team, and they're hugely popular. There's no pro sports in Montana. The Grizzlies football team of the University of Montana is the biggest franchise in the state. You know, it's really tough in that town to convict a football player because they're put on this pedestal. They're heroes. They're paragons of everything.
So once she got this tape-recorded confession, what did she do next?
Well, she was really torn. I mean, she has PTSD. The research shows that women, when they're raped, typically the first response for women, those common responses, I think I might have been raped. I wonder what did I do? Was that my fault? Which then the defense attorneys always used against them. But that's the natural reaction. You don't want to believe that you were raped. And one, your mind plays tricks on you. If you can convince yourself you're not raped, you think you still have control of your life. To be raped, I mean, rape is such a different kind of trauma. To be penetrated in your most private parts, against your will is...
And bite her best friend.
Right. And this is... So what that does to your trust, think about that. This is someone she used to talk about with Beau around, no one's going to dare rape me. I mean, she relied on him to protect her, and now he is the rapist. So that just turned her world upside down, and she went into denial about many things, including the fact that she was traumatized and had PTSD. So... And she didn't want to ruin Beau's life. So for the first 15 months afterwards, she tried to pretend things were okay. Then she ran into him at a bar, and he mocked her.
Oh.
And she made him promise the day after when she got the confession that you have to promise me you'll get therapy. You have to promise me you'll deal with your alcoholism. You have to promise me that, you know, your drug problems. And if I ever hear anything that you've done this to anyone else, I'm going right to the police. So when he mocked her and he was drinking and clearly had no remorse, she went to the cops.
John Krakauer, his new book is titled Missoula, Rape and the Justice System in a College Town. Short break here, and when we come back, we'll talk more. Take your calls, your email. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations. And from Constant Contact, proud supporter of small businesses and nonprofits. Constant Contact's email marketing works to help organizations promote themselves online, connecting with current and new customers. More at ConstantContact.com. And from The Forward, a newspaper and website for Jewish perspectives on news, culture, and opinion. This week, The Forward profiles an African-American surgeon who wants his community to be more like Orthodox Jews. More at Forward.com.
Welcome back. John Krakauer is with me. I know you know him well. But the kind of book he's written this time may surprise you. It's titled Missoula, Rape and the Justice System in a College Town. And before the break, he was talking about a young woman, Allison Huguette, who was raped by someone she considered her very best friend. Indeed, the next day, he came to her house and apologized. She had, unbeknownst to him, tape-recorded that confession. But the next time she saw him, he mocked her. And that really changed her mind, John.
It did. And so she went to the police. And I should say that in these 15 months where she had given him this chance, he was going around town. And Missoula is a small town. And they all went to high school together. And he was going around telling everyone he knew and his family that the sex was consensual, that they'd been having sex many times before, which is all not true. They were never close to being romantically involved. So at the same time he's confessed to her, he's spreading these lies. So everyone in town believes, oh, she's lying. You know, that's what rapists do, is they dismiss the victims as liars. So she finally was angry, and she realized she was going crazy. She was literally acting crazy. So she went to the cops, and then the detective, a very good detective, Guy Baker, convinced her to allow him to tape a call of her calling Beau back and getting another confession that could be recorded and could be admissible in court. And she said that was the hardest thing she'd ever done in her life, to, you know, do this call that she knew would probably put her one-time friend in jail for a long time. So she did it. He confessed again. It is now pretty much a slam dunk case. They arrested him. They got another tape confession that was admissible. And then they entered into a series of plea negotiations. I mean, you know, he's been caught confessing. He doesn't want to go to trial, so you might assume that they could get a stiff sentence, make a plea deal. Well, it turned out then for the next, I don't know, it was 6 or 8 months, they went through what should have been a simple... The problem was the prosecutors didn't want to throw the book at him. They wanted to slap him on the wrist. They kept saying, well, if it goes to trial, you don't know how it'll turn out. This is Missoula. This is football town. He's a football player. He could get off with no time at all. And they were right. But for whatever reason, the prosecutor's office was extremely reluctant.
Huh.
And what happened, the good thing was there's... Allison was raped in the fall of 2010, and there followed a series of other rapes, including a gang rape in 2010 that I write about, of a different victim, and another gang rape by football players. Both of these are gang rapes by football players in 2011. And a local reporter named Gwen Florio in 2011 wrote about that second gang rape, and then started over the next year or more, a couple of years, she wrote about 100 articles. So she's courageous. This is a football town. The sports writers weren't writing about this. I mean, there were rumors all over town. She was the one who wrote about it. You can't believe the abuse she suffered online, letters. You know, she was just vilified for their beloved football team. You know, she's just trying to destroy the football program. But she did it. She stuck with it. And that brought this series of rapes to the attention of the U.S. Department of Justice. And while Allison's case was, this plea negotiations was going on, the Justice Department announced, we're going to investigate Missoula for, at the time, they listed 80 rapes they were investigating. And she said, great. You know, she was the one who accidentally tipped off the prosecutors, said they're going to, DOJ is investigating, this is going to be good. And the prosecutors got nervous and they said, she realized something's up. They didn't think that was good news at all. And so this dragged out and dragged out. And one thing I learned is that I always assumed that if you're a victim of a rape and you want a prosecution to happen, all you got to say is, yeah, I want a press charge and it will happen. But it's not up to you. In almost every state, and Montana's one of them, it's up to the prosecutor. It's not your decision because it's the state versus the rapist, not the victim. So the victim has no say whether the prosecution happens or not.
Talk about this county prosecutor, Kirsten Pabst.
Well, at the time... that Allison started pursuing this prosecution, there was a chief deputy county prosecutor, the number two person in the office, was a woman named Kirsten Pabst. She was in charge of the sexual assaults. She'd been in that office for 15 years. She'd been running the sexual assault cases for 6 years. And it turned out she was extremely reluctant to prosecute cases. Of the DOJ investigation turned up 114 cases of adult women who'd been sexually assaulted, in which these are 114 cases, not total cases, but these are cases where the police investigated, found probable cause for prosecution, and sent them to the prosecutor's office. Of those 114 cases, Kirsten Pabst, or the deputies she was supervising, prosecuted exactly 14. Now, she brags on her website that she has a 99% success rate at trial. Well, that's because she doesn't prosecute cases unless they're absolute slam dunks. If it's at all difficult, if there's alcohol involved, she almost never prosecuted. And the fact is, alcohol plays a role in most cases. So, and when women would complain, a couple of women went to Gwen Florio and complained about how they were treated by the prosecutors and the police, and she vilified these victims, not by name, but for the next 2 years, she said, you know, these victims, because they lied about being raped, is what brought on this whole DOJ investigation. And so she's this very problematic person.
And she is now the county attorney.
A little bit of backstory. So when Allison's case was being negotiated, She quit. Kirsten Papps quit being a prosecutor out of the blue, very sudden, said she wanted to spend more time with her family and horses. What she really was doing was she signed up about the same time in February and March of 2012. The star quarterback of the football team, brilliant quarterback, extremely popular guy, the most popular guy in Montana, was accused of raping a student. And he was charged by the university and later by the county. And Kirsten Papps, the former prosecutor, signed on to be co-counsel, his defense counsel, to defend the quarterback. She defended him. I write about this at length in the book. She kept him out of jail, got him acquitted by a very dishonest, as many of these defenses are. But in any case, she acquitted him. And then she was so popular for keeping the star quarterback out of jail, she, after having quit the prosecutor's office, she went back, ran to be the head prosecutor, the Missoula County attorney, and she won by a pretty wide margin. And as of last January, she is now running the prosecutor's office. She's the one that if you're a victim of sexual assault, your fate is in her hands. And this is a woman who has gone on the record repeatedly criticizing cases that were prosecuted for not having, you know, she says, oh, there wasn't, she said the quarterback should never have been charged. There wasn't enough evidence. There was so much evidence. The victim in that case, whom in the book I call Cecilia Washburn, so she is sexually assaulted. She's raped. Within a couple of minutes of being raped, she texts her roommate who's sitting outside the door saying, oh, my God, I think I might have just been raped. I pushed and pushed. I said no, but he forced himself on me. That's a text. It's got a timestamp. You know, when they did a forensic gynecological exam, which showed, trauma that was consistent with sexual assault. There were bruises on her chest. The quarterback had admitted in court that he pinned her down with all his weight on her arms. There was all this evidence. And this is, the prosecutor says, that's not enough not to convict. She's saying that's not even enough to charge him. He should never be charged. And this woman, you know, is now the head prosecutor.
So you filed an FOIA, a FOIA request regarding the case of quarterback Jordan Johnson. And your request is now before the state Supreme Court.
Right. So one thing people have to know is, so there's, if you're a student at a university in this country, you're raped, you have two avenues of recourse. You can file criminal charges, as Cecilia Washburn, Jordan Johnson's victim, did. And you can go to the university and ask for, the most the university can do is expel the assailant. They can't put him in jail. They can't put him on a sex offender list. But it's a lower burden of proof. Cecilia Washburn started that. Jordan Johns was found guilty in the first level of investigation by the dean of students. Johnson appealed to the next level, to the vice president. He was found guilty again. He appealed to the next level, to the university court of seven individuals that have a long hearing. He was found guilty of that by a vote of 5-2, and they voted 7-0 to expel him. The president examined the investigation, said, I find this investigation was done correctly. You are expelled. Your career is over. I'm sorry. Should have been a done deal. But he had one more appeal out of the university system to the Commissioner of Higher Education, and then the case just disappeared, but he never was expelled. And they, because
he
of.
He never was expelled.
No. And we're still, there's these privacy laws, FERPA, the law is called, this Privacy Act to protect student privacy, which is important. But universities use this to keep from being transparent. So once it went to the commissioner's office, they wouldn't even say if it had been appealed. They just, you know, I asked what they just said. We're not going to say, you know, anything happened. But he came back and was a quarterback again, so he wasn't expelled. And I did some digging and found out what happened, and that was that in 2011, the federal government, the Department of Education, issued a letter to every college and university in the country. It's called the Dear Colleague Letter, and it said, "We have a rape problem. So what you need to do is you need to change the burden of proof. You need to make it easier to expel these bad students." So the old burden was called clear and convincing evidence. You have to show clear and convincing evidence. Now we're going to lower it a little bit to a preponderance of evidence. more likely than not. It's a very small, it's the same burden of proof as used in almost all civil law. It's reasonable, but it's easier to convict. So what happened with Jordan Johnson's lawyers, they convinced the commissioner to go back to the old clear and convincing. And so the commissioner, they kicked it back to the school. The new dean, the old dean who was really good, had retired. But the new dean, well, first of all, we're going to reinvestigate this by clear and convincing evidence, the higher burden. So they hired an outside consultant, totally impartial, totally qualified, approved by all parties. He went back, looked at the evidence, said, Jordan Johnson is not credible. He is guilty by clear and convincing evidence. Should have been a done deal. The new dean said, no. And she overturned it. And the victim had no chance after all these appeals that Johnson got. The victim was given no chance to appeal. Jordan Johnson returned as the quarterback. The town was overjoyed. The football team started winning again. And the poor victim was... I was at the trial when the criminal trial, when he was acquitted, thanks to Kirsten Papst and her co-counsel, and it was so disheartening. The whole football team was there cheering, and Twitter lit up with, criticizing the victim for she should be prosecuted. You know, she's a liar. She deserves, whatever. It was just disgusting.
So this is why you are getting so much grief from Missoula. How many rapes did you find had taken place at that college?
Well, the Department of Justice, the DOJ, did a study of just over 4 years, very comprehensive study. The prosecutor's office wouldn't turn over their records, so that hampered them, but they did a good job. And they found over these 52 months, just over 4 years, they found 350 cases of sexual assault that they studied. They brought in an eminent policeman, an eminent prosecutor, totally unbiased to evaluate them. And it was appalling what they found. They found that the prosecutor's office seldom would prosecute any cases that involved drugs or alcohol. They found cases in which there had been signed confessions or videotaped evidence in one case of someone putting a drug into a drink. And they wouldn't prosecute those cases. The prosecutor after that was at, see, Pabst, she quit right before the investigation. So even though those cases were under her watch, she wasn't there during the investigation. So when she ran for election, she came back, I'm the reformer, don't blame it on me. And her boss was the guy who took the fall for that.
John Krakauer, and his new book is titled Missoula: Rape and the Justice System in a College Town. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We've got lots of callers. Gonna open the phones, 800-433-8850. Send your email to drshow@wamu.org. Let's first go to Hillary in Charlotte, North Carolina. You're on the air.
Thank you, Ms. Rehm, for having me on the air. And thank you so much for writing this book that has caused attention to come to such an important issue. I'm following up between your book with respect to rape in colleges. And Tierney Sneed recently wrote an article for U.S. News about rape in middle school and high school. Now, I have to be honest with you, I never thought I would be asking anybody to report on rape in elementary school. But recently, some events have happened in my own child's elementary school where I realized that the rape culture that you're highlighting of victim blaming, where it plays into how the courts handle rape victims and how that plays into how society handles rape. It's just a vicious cycle. I never thought that it would impact children, 10 and 11-year-old children. And yet, with a recent event at my child's school, child is threatening to rape other kids and pushing them to the ground and thrusting into them. And I'm shocked at how much victim blaming is going on there.
That is really disturbing. And I would hope that by now the school, the principal, the school district has pulled that kid out of school. I mean, as a precautionary measure, that has to happen. I mean, that is extremely disturbing. It's disturbing that a kid like that would display those kind of tendencies. I mean, there's something...
At such a young age, and somehow, perhaps by example, by hearing about how much rape goes on, begin as a young child to display those kinds of characteristics. The book is titled Missoula, Rape and the Justice System in a College Town. John Krakauer is with me. We'll take a short break and take more of your calls when we come back. Stay with us.
Support for NPR comes from NPR member stations and from the Doris Duke Charitable Foundation, working to improve the quality of people's lives by supporting the performing arts, the environment, medical research, and child well-being. Information is available at ddcf.org. From the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, working together to build a culture of health for all, on the web at rwjf.org. And from the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
On the next Fresh Air, we'll talk about the chaos in Yemen, which has become a haven for Al-Qaeda and extremist rebels, and the repercussions that chaos might have for the U.S. Our guest will be Gregory Johnson, who has reported from Yemen, wrote a book about it, and was nearly kidnapped on his last trip. Join us.
John Krakauer is with me. He has a brand new book titled Missoula, Rape and the Justice System in a College Town. I said at the outset, John, that you clearly have kicked a hornet's nest. How have the folks in Missoula reacted?
Well, a great number of them are very upset. They're upset by the fact that I'm writing about their town. You know, Missoula, the rape rate in Missoula is actually a little less than national average. And that's one of the reasons I wanted to write about it. It's a typical city. It's not any different than most places. So I picked it, and it's a case study. They especially objected to the title, Missoula, rape in the justice system in a college town. Why couldn't you have picked a different title? Well, I don't work for the Chamber of Commerce. You know, this I thought was a really good title. I like the title. It's not sensational. It's very concise. It's accurately describes what the book's about. But Missoulians, this is their, it's a beautiful town. They feel, somehow impugned. But, you know, there's not enough discussion about the victim. It's all about our poor town. You know, what about the victims? What about the fact that this happened in your town?
And you're going back to that town to speak.
On May 6th, I'm going to go back and face my critics. There's going to be some kind of forum organized. There's a great bookstore in Missoula, Fact and Fiction, and the owner of that bookstore has organized this forum. I don't know who else is going to be in it, but I'd love it if Kirsten Papps was there. I hope she's there. I hope representatives from the police and the university. And I've proposed to the bookstore owner, Barbara Theroux, that she allow Allison Hewitt to be on the forum. And I really hope Allison wants to be there. She's a victim. She should be on that forum, too. So we'll see how that develops.
Here are a couple of emails. First is rape part of athletic culture, especially football and basketball. And then David asks, do you see a lot of parallels with the Jameis Winston case at Florida State University and how the talent has the police mishandled the case at every step?
You know, football culture is definitely part of the problem, and it's because football players in our culture, our society, are put on pedestals. They get a free pass. They get a literal get out of jail free card, and so they're not held accountable. And the Jameis Winston case at Florida State, there are a lot of parallels. Now, the police in Tallahassee were much more egregious, their actions, than the police in the Missoula police are really pretty good for the most part. They're disheartened because it's so hard to get the prosecutors to prosecute the cases they bring them. The DOJ showed that the police, there's this resignation. Why should we bother investing so much in these investigations that the prosecutors are just going to say, oh, they're drinking, we're not going to do anything with it?
Here's a comment from Barley Ant, who says, the two cases that the news media emphasized, the Duke lacrosse team and the UVA case that Rolling Stone reported, both fell apart. On campus, rapes do happen and are prosecuted. Why did the media emphasize two cases that did not happen? Maybe because in both cases, the alleged rapists were privileged.
I don't know why. I mean, I think the media jumped on both those cases because they were so horrifying. They were, you know, really, really terrible gang rapes, alleged gang rapes that never happened. And the media didn't do their homework. In the case of the Duke case, you had a rogue prosecutor who wasn't revealing exculpatory evidence. He was not being truthful. He was issuing untruthful statements to the media. In the Rolling Stone UVA fiasco, it was the reporter and her editors simply went with a story they had not checked out carefully.
Tell us about the psychologist David Lissack and how prosecutors tried to actually prevent him from testifying.
David Lissack has done groundbreaking research. He's perhaps the leading or one of the leading academics who's done research into acquaintance rape. And it's fascinating research. And so before I tell what the prosecutors did, I should tell you some of the things he's discovered. He's done all this research into the neurobiology of trauma, how when you're traumatized by being sexually assaulted, your brain chemistry changes, the way you process memory changes. Many victims go into, when they're being raped, they freeze. They just become immobile. Why didn't you resist? You know, he didn't have a gun. But research shows that all animals, many species of animals, when they face a mortal threat, they just, it's called, you know, this the flight, fight, fight, or freeze response, tonic immobility, they freeze up. And this has been shown, research shows that this happens to humans as well, where women talk about, I couldn't move my limbs. That's not imaginary. That's a biological phenomenon. Lissack also showed that, most rapes are done by a relatively small proportion of rapists, these serial predators who are responsible for an average of 6 rapes and 8 other assaults. And so, you know, if you start prosecuting any given rapist, there's a start investigating and prosecuting, there's a 90% chance you're going to catch a serial rapist who's responsible for multiple rapes. So you gotta go after him. And the prosecutors were really worried in the Jordan Johnson case that Lisak would present this hard science, you know, backed by peer-reviewed research. So they had a pretrial motion to bar him from the trial. When the judge, who was a really good judge, Karen Townsend, allowed him, then they couldn't attack the science. So Kirsten Papst launched this amazing ad hominem attack on his personality. One of the first things she brought up was, huh, you were sexually assaulted when you were a child, right? Trying to rattle him. And he was. He's been open about this. And she says, well, doesn't that prejudice you for, you know, now you just reflexively take the side of it. And that was such a low blow. But she did it. That's what defense attorneys do. And then throughout the trial, he used to be a professor at, at University of Boston, Boston University. And so when she's introducing him, you used to be a professor. You're a professor, right? From Boston, right? And for the rest of the trial, he would be denigrated as, this is the West, you know. He was the East Coast effete intellectual, the professor from Boston, the Boston. They never referred to him by name, the Boston professor. They must have said that 100 times.
All right, let's go to Ben in Littleton, New Hampshire. You're on the air.
Thank you so much for taking my call, Dan.
Sure.
Wonderful show today.
Thank you.
Just a few comments, then I'll get right off the phone. The first is about the author had spoken about the judicial system and how the prosecution is done by the DAs, obviously not by the police or the universities. And it's very, very common, unfortunately, in this country that two crimes can be committed and be the exact same events, the exact same circumstances. And depending on who the victim and the alleged perpetrator is, the charges can be vastly different, if at all. The more specific thing I wanted to comment on, which no one seems to have hit yet, is that the reason that sports people are typically put on a pretty high pedestal is it equals a lot of money for these universities and prestige, even if they're not nationally known. And schools don't want to lose that luster on their goalposts, and they want to make sure that it appears to mom and dad that it's a very safe place to send their children and their money.
That's right. I mean, Missoula is a small town, and their team is not in the highest tier of college football, but they're as fanatical in Missoula about their football team as anywhere. And they identify with the team. The Grizz are Missoula. I mean, it's this – you can't – so these are their heroes. No one wants to believe their heroes are predators, so it's easier to go into denial, and that's what they do.
Do you truly believe that Missoula – is representative of other colleges around the country?
Oh, that's what's so horrifying is Missoula is pretty typical. I mean, it's not the worst example. It's better than many. I mean, the university system there, the university's procedures are better than many schools. The cops and even the prosecutors are better. I mean, the prosecutors in Missoula are talented, they're dedicated, but the atmosphere, the climate in that office, thanks to the – it just had – turn into this resignation, this refusal to prosecute challenging cases. They're overworked, they're short on resources, and so they wouldn't try and prosecute the tough cases.
All right, to Therese in Lansing, Michigan, you're on the air.
Thank you for taking my call. I wanted to ask you if at any time during after this book has come out, if you feel, if you're worried about your own safety, especially coming into this town hall meeting or whatever. Are you worried about your safety?
No. No, I'm not. I mean, I've been receiving death threats for a long time. I started receiving death threats for Into the Wild and Into Thin Air. So it's not like, you know, it's the internet. It's easy to, you know, I take some of them I take seriously. And I've told some people that if I die, who the first suspect should be, people close to mm-hmm. me. But I think that's extremely unlikely. I think people, it makes them feel good to, you know, spout off anonymously. But, yeah.
Let's go now to Janine in Arlington, Washington. You're on the air.
I have been raped. I'm 81 years old now, and I lost my virginity at 18. I had joined the Air Force. I worked at a Strategic Air Command base, and I started going, and I hadn't dated much. I didn't know much about boys or men. And the guy that I really liked, his name was Pablo Cruz. He was a corporal, and I was a PFC. And I was so traumatized, and it was in a building that was being built where it happened. Went back to the barracks with blood running down my legs and showered. I didn't tell anyone. I don't know. It was a few days later when I ended up having some sort of a seizure or whatever happening. I was in the upper bunk in my barracks, and somehow they came in, medics or whatever, and I was flown in an airplane to a hospital with a nervous breakdown, and I never did tell anyone what happened. Then we had sort of a court hearing, and I was given my choice of staying in the Air Force and keeping my stripe or losing my stripe and getting out, and I got a general discharge. I had been a dreamer. I wanted to see the world, and my life, I've been lifelong affected, but that wasn't the first. The same guy raped me the second time. I was in the NCO club. This is before I actually ended up in the hospital. I was in the NCO club, and he was dragging me out. I was trying to resist and took me to the woods and raped me again. And I guess it was after that I was so traumatized that that's when I ended up with a nervous breakdown.
Oh, Janine, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I'm sure you've heard many.
It's heartbreaking.
Like
it's heartbreaking. That. There are way too many of them.
There are way too many of them, and so often the victim is the one who is targeted.
That's right, and that's why 80%, at least 80% of the rapes in this country are not reported to authorities, because victims have learned how they will be treated and blamed, and the trauma of what follows the rape is, in many ways, as traumatizing as the rape itself for victims.
And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go now to Barbara. She's in Richmond, Virginia. You're on the air.
Hi, Diane.
Hi,
John.
Hi.
Thank you for having this program. I'm at home today painting and listening to you, which I've been doing all week. And this is very difficult for me to listen to. But I wanted to thank you for saying what you just said about women freeze and don't think of fighting back or can't fight back. I was raped when I was 16 years old. I'm 57 years old, and obviously you don't forget it. And I never heard anybody say that before, that many women don't do anything, that they freeze. And I just wanted to thank you for that, because I didn't do anything. I froze, and I've never told anybody about it. My family doesn't know. My best friends don't know, and no one knows.
I hope that you, having said this, as you now have on the air, will not only feel some release, but will talk to someone else about it. I think that's kind of the only way you can begin to deal with the pain. What do you think, John?
I think that's right. And I also think by coming out, you embolden other women to come out. And this collective, you know, support is really important for victims. And hopefully that's starting to happen more and more. And maybe there'll be a tipping point reached that will, you know, affect the way people think about rape from that.
So, John, what's next on this Missoula journey for you?
I never walk away from my books. I continually revise them and update them. I continually do research. I'm continuing to investigate Kirsten Pabst, and I have this FOIA petition before the Montana Supreme Court. And if I win that, I'll receive thousands of pages more of documents. So in the paperback edition of the book, which, I don't know, it'll come out in 6-9 months, a year, there will be a significant addition to the book to report whatever else I find.
How does your wife, your family, feel about your having done this book?
My wife she said she's proud of me. She's glad I'm doing it, but it's way too upsetting for her. She has not read the book and is not sure she'll be able to read the book. Rape, you know, it affects me, a lot of people, in a lot of different ways. It's very, very personal. After the book was announced, whenever it was, a couple months ago, many of my female acquaintances and friends come up to me and said, I've never told you this, but I was raped. including a 71-year-old woman who I met when I was 18, who I'd shown an early draft of the manuscript to, who was raped by, when she was a virgin, a freshman at a Western university, by a hockey player. I mean, and so, you know, I anecdotally, this is so prevalent. And the statistics are hard to read because it's hard to rely on because so many rapes go unreported. But it's a huge problem in this country. I mean, it's a huge problem that people are so reluctant to confront. It's just easier to sweep it under the rug and not think about something so painful.
And we need to shed more light on it and not focus so much on those instances where it turns out it's not true.
I mean, yeah, because, sure, 2 to 10% of people, the best research shows, of victims falsely accused. But 97% of rapists get away with it without any accountability.
John Krakauer, he's a best-selling author of Into Thin Air, Into the Wild, and Under the Banner of Heaven. This latest book is titled Missoula, Rape and the Justice System in a College Town. John, thank you for writing this book.
Thanks so much for having me on the show and for doing what you've been doing for so many years.
Thank you. And thanks all for listening. I'm Diane Reed.